views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not
because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our special Wednesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in, and a great show planned for you tonight with our guest in Japan. First, a couple of announcements for all of you. If you would like to call us and talk to our guest, Dr. Patrick Collins, 1-866-687-7223. Is our toll-free number. Remember, no call screener, so let the phone ring, be patient, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And remember, we do answer the phone during the break, and if we have a caller on the line, we can hold you over the break, or sometimes we skip the break. But the toll-free number is our preferred way of communicating with you, the listener. So again, 1-866-687-7223. You can, of course, use email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can use our blog, which is off of our website. So go to thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right to the upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed, and that is our archive page for this show. Open it up. Scroll all the way to the bottom where the comment section is, and then you can post your question or your comment for Dr. Collins. And as soon as you do that, I will get it, and I can bring it up on air at the right moment or as soon as possible. While you're at our website, thespaceshow.com, do check out our detailed website newsletter. You'll see it center right of our homepage. It is uploaded new every Sunday after the Sunday Space Show. It has all of the details of the programs for the week. But if you scroll down, it also shows you who is scheduled for the for certain dates. And we're booking through the end of 2017 already. So you can see our schedule is getting full. I think we're totally full with October and a little bit left in November, a little bit left in December. But you can see who's on board for it. If you have guest suggestions that you would like us to consider bringing on as a guest, please send me a note and tell me who it is and why you think they should be a guest. And above all, if you have contact information, including email addresses, please include that. We also have an email newsletter that goes out at 6 a.m. Monday morning, California time. And if you would like to be on that list, please email me with your address and I'll add you to it. It's very short, guaranteed not to clutter up your inbox. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or very rapidly download the show onto whatever mobile device or computer you may be using. There's a menu upper left, and if you look for our store that sells t-shirts and coffee mugs and things like that, it's under the support menu on that upper left menu. So do check that out. Check out Listen Live, and this tells you how to listen to live Space Show programs, how to listen to our archive programs, podcasting programs per your device that you're listening on. And for those of you now using Alexa, the TuneIn player is embedded there, and you can listen to Space Show programs on Alexa. If you have any questions or comments, please don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. The other thing I'd like to point out on the website is the Support the Space Show, again, center right on the homepage. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3. Our parent is ONE, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we would not be bringing you this program were it not for those of you who financially donate and support the Space Show. So we're deeply appreciative of your support. By the way, I know I'm behind on thank you notes. I hope to get caught up on that by this weekend. And so we do thank you. And again, we also have corporate and sponsors, and you can see their banner ads going across our homepage. Click on those banner ads from time to time. The sponsor does change the content underneath those banner ads, so check them out. And then we also read a short message, because those sponsors do sponsor both the first part of the space show and then the second segment of the space show. And we do have sponsorships available. And then, of course, for 2018, we'll be opening up for sponsorships really any time. But we get aggressive about that after Thanksgiving, the Thanksgiving holiday for those of you in the United States. For the first segment tonight of our program, the New Worlds Conference is a sponsor. This is Rick Tumlinson's gig in Austin, Texas. It is November 10th through the 11th. And get all of their information for this really cool event. And if you are going, I want to hear from you. I'd love for you to call an open line show or set up coming on the show and tell me about it. Unfortunately, I'll be talking at Rutgers University, and I won't be able to attend. Anyway, their website is newworlds2017.space. And then the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor. Remember, this is a 100-year forecast for our future in space. The plan includes Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. And it's all on their website, which is www.thespaceplan.com. And you can view the space plan online, which is interactive, and it has over 500 elements that open up for even more information. You can buy a very cool full-size integrated space plan poster, and you will really like that. And then there is a space plan for children. So check that out on their website as well, thespaceplan.com. And the Space Foundation is our sponsor, and their 34th symposium is just around the corner. Don't miss the 34th Space Symposium. It is the premier global space conference. The dates this coming year, April 16th through the 19th, in Colorado Springs, Colorado, at the Broadmoor Hotel. Their website, spacesymposium.org, and we will have more about that event as we get closer and closer to it. That brings me to our program tonight, and first of all, our guest is Dr. Patrick Collins. I want to publicly acknowledge and thank him for his willingness to move the Tuesday show, which is our normal show, to Wednesday. This allowed me to attend a genetic engineering and genetic editing conference at Stanford University with participants from Stanford, UCSF Med School, and UC Berkeley on gene editing for various illnesses, specifically cystic fibrosis, which of course is interesting for me. But I met people working with CRISPR and working with gene editing and the things we talk about for space. And I will soon be bringing several of the speakers on board the space show so you can get a real factual understanding of CRISPR gene editing technology, how you would get that edited gene absorbed into the human body, and does that edited gene go every place in the body, or do you have to target like the stomach or the liver or the lungs or the heart? Really interesting area. So for those of you that think gene editing is the way to go for long duration human spaceflight and CRISPR is going to open the window for all of this, you're not going to want to miss these programs when I bring these people on. So that's going to be happening between now and the end of the year. And I think you'll really enjoy those shows, and I'll make sure I highlight them. But I do want to thank Patrick for moving his program to tonight. Dr. Patrick Collins, besides being the very first ever space show guest, going back nearly 17 years, is a well-known and respected authority on space economics, space tourism, reusable launch vehicles, and space solar power. He is a professor of economics at Azabu University, which is in Japan, and he's an advisor to a number of companies and organizations. His research for the past 25 years has been how to stimulate growth of commercial space activities, the two main opportunities being tourism and energy supply. He did the first market research on space tourism back in 1993 in Japan, Then he revised it with collaboration in the United States in 1995. And you should read his bio, because he has been really active in this area. By the way, his surveys and his work formed a big part of my doctoral dissertation back in those years when I was writing that, and Patrick had the only credible work that would meet academic standards by any means. So there is a long, long, long connection with the space show and Patrick. So do read his bio so you can get all of the information. I don't want to just keep reading about him, although he is a co-founder of Space Renaissance International. Just a whole lot of things. So, Patrick, rather than read about you, which I could do for the whole first segment easily, how are you? Well, just start talking.
Well, thanks, David, for that very kind invitation. Yeah, indeed, it's we've been on and off in contact for years now, and it's a great pleasure seeing the space show do so successfully. I mean, I don't think you could have imagined when you started how it was going to continue and grow like this. It's really, you've done terrific work.
No, I couldn't even, back when I started it, imagine 17 years in the future. And then, you know, I think that when your show came on, it was the first space show program, and that was July 1st of 2001. And then we were going strong, and I was getting excited, and then 9/11 happened, and I really thought that would be the end of the space show. But a couple of people were willing to talk even right after 9/11. So I remember at the time Pat Dash was the head of the National Space Society, and she was a guest, and she kept her appointment and came on the show. And she had a clear view of the Pentagon from where she was, and we talked about that and the National Space Society and the importance of space in the aftermath of something like 9/11 that none of us understood. My Stanford professor, dissertation advisor, Bruce Lucinian, was on the show several times after that. So, you know, life kind of went on as we tried to figure things out, and it wasn't the end of the space show or, you know, space development or commercial space or anything like that. And so maybe it created opportunities, I don't know, but the world did not come to an end, although it's a very, very tragic event.
Right.
That was...
And the technology has moved forward, because I guess you were just sitting by a phone before, and now you've got a kind of a suite of screens you're working with.
Well, yeah, I didn't have email when I started. People could fax in a message, so it was really hard doing an international program like tonight. I didn't have email. I relied on the radio station. I was on an AM radio station in Phoenix, Arizona when you did the show. So they sent me a cassette. Remember those little cassettes, you know, C30, C60?
Yeah.
So they sent me a cassette recording of the show, which is all I had. I didn't really have an easy way to make it digital, but I didn't have any use for making it digital at the time. So I was collecting cassette tape recorders. Eventually we turned them all into digital format, but that was not for several years. But if I didn't get a phone call or a fax, then I didn't have any listener
right.
participation. That was the only way. Once we opened it up for email, we got rid of the fax machine, and we still have the toll-free number, but everybody wants to use email, so it's hard to drive phone calls on the show. But, yeah, it's a totally different world with computers and hardware, and I couldn't dream of doing this show from home in an Internet deal back in 2001. I mean, that didn't happen until, like, 2004 or 2005. There were no podcasts back then. I mean, it's not that long ago, people. It really isn't.
But
let's go further back, because Patrick, go further back, because these early days of October are very, very historical for space, starting in the 50s, maybe even before the 50s, but certainly in the 50s and 60s. Give us a little bit of a historical sense to space for the early part of October.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's a good reason for this show today. We've got three great big round figure dates. I mean, today is the 60th anniversary of Sputnik 1, so the first ever object put into orbit, you know, a terrifically historic. And it's also the 75th anniversary. Yesterday, the October the 3rd, is the 75th anniversary of the first ever rocket reaching space on a suborbital flight. And
what was that rocket? What was the rocket that reached space?
Well, it was
for a non-suborbital.
It was the A-4 rocket being developed and later becoming the V-2 missile during the war. So 1942, 3rd of October, was the first successful flight. You know, they'd had a number of flights. But I'll talk about that a little bit more, because they'd had a number of failures, and that was the first success. But just the other third, you know, good historic date is on the 10th of October. We have the 50th anniversary of the Outer Space Treaty from 1967. And again, you know, that's a totally different deal, United Nations and big negotiated agreement and so on, but really historic, you know, and kind of visionary. And I hope that, you know, the vision will be revived once we get space travel really, really big and growing. Because it was, you know, the United Nations, for all its flaws, is an attempt for, you know, international coordination on issues that we all agree on. And pretty well everyone agreed to have a treaty that space doesn't belong to any one nation, and we should all be able to go there and come back and so on. So that's a good date as well. The end of this, what they call Space Week, isn't it? October the 4th.
Right. And, you know, a lot of people don't like the Outer Space Treaty and critique it, but it is still very much alive and still very much in force and seems to be adaptable to most things, except the property rights issues seem to, you know, be a challenge for the Outer Space Treaty as we reach out for more, you know, like deep space mining, in situ resources, things of that nature. Possibly the treaty will be pretty strained there. And then I guess if a private company wants to go to Mars with people and planetary protection says, no, you can't go, that's Article 9 of the Outer Space Treaty, that treaty might find some challenges there, too. I mean, that's a possibility.
That's right. I mean, law has to evolve, doesn't it? And I'm not so, I don't have details, don't remember the details of it, but that's right. And, of course, there's a famous issue in law called de facto law. When somebody does something, and because they do it, and nobody stops them, it becomes law. And that was one of the really big issues of Sputnik 1. If you remember, it was launched, and when it was in orbit for about 3 weeks, and repeatedly flew over the United States. And this created what they call de facto law, that if you are in space, you're allowed to fly over other countries without their permission. And, I mean, of course, at some point you have to have that law because space is so huge. And that's famous, that where space begins is not defined in law, but generally speaking, it's over 100 kilometers or so. And, I mean, if Sputnik 1 wasn't a threat at all to the United States, but it was perceived that it might be a threat, you know, if it had bombs on board or something. And so, but the United States couldn't stop it. They didn't have any missiles that could bring down Sputnik 1. And so then they, of course, took the opportunity, and then they sent satellites into orbit, which flew over the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union couldn't stop them either. And so de facto law, it became...
Well, it became
a piece of law.
Yeah, and it actually got challenged and then became a treaty law because it was the Bolivia Convention where they tried to stop the overflight, I think in Bolivia, that's why it's named after that, of satellites going over without permission. And, of course, since it was already being done everywhere, it prevailed. And so I think that's called
right.
The Bolivia.
I didn't know about the Bolivia Convention.
Yeah, yeah. So I...
Because, you know, you have to, at some height... You know, if you go out to the height of the moon, I mean, the moon is overflying people's countries in orbit, so there's got to be a dividing point at some point. But certainly 100 kilometers is quite low. And, you know, that's funny. Japan is very worked up at the moment because North Korea keeps flying missiles over Japan. But it's actually not illegal because it's several hundred kilometers above Japan. And so Japan, you know, they do complain, but it's not illegal on Korea's part. So they're kind of poking fun at Japan, rather, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with that is they're not just looking for intelligence. They're possibly flying weapons or practicing to fly weapons. So you've got a whole different thing. I don't think it's legal to fly weapons over a country. I don't know.
So far, they haven't flown bombs over Japan. I mean, they're just missiles that could carry bombs, for sure. Yeah. And then there's a lot of, you know, what's the word, sort of annoying, bombast about it, you know, saying we could use this to attack you. But as far as I understand, they haven't done anything illegal so far, you know, because of this piece of de facto law.
Hopefully they won't. Hopefully they won't do anything more severe than
crazy.
What they're doing.
Yeah.
But
of course. I hope it's going to be defused.
And I guess that has a little something to do with space, since the missiles probably, I don't know if they go through space or not to get to Japan, because that's relatively close. But to go further, they certainly go ballistically into space and then come back down through reentry. So I'm not sure.
To the outer space treaty, though, what I suspect will happen is that there will be some de facto law, like somebody will finally send a mining satellite to an asteroid and bring back a whole lot of stuff and say, you know, this is ours, and no one will be able to stop them. And so the treaty will be amended, in effect, de facto, I guess.
Well, the U.S. sort of did that in 2015 with the U.S. commercial space law that sort of quasi-established property rights, and now Luxembourg is doing it, and the United Arab Emirates are doing it, and there are some other countries that are pushing for the same kind of thing. So you're probably right. It is starting to spread, and of course nobody can go out there and do anything about it yet. But my hunch is that when they start being able to do it, that there won't be any severe resistance. I don't
eventually.
Think so. Yeah, eventually. But I think if they don't find a way to cooperatively amend or change or do something with the treaty, it will be de facto changed, as you say it will, as you're suggesting.
Yeah.
But so October's been a busy time, hasn't it, for space?
Right. So the Sputnik 1 is the thing that's remembered on October the 4th. And it's the reason why, I think they call it International Space Week, isn't it? It starts on October the 4th.
Something like that,
And the rocket that launched the Sputnik 1, we now call it the Soyuz, but it was then the R-7, which was, in fact, the Soviet Union's first intercontinental missile that could fly and drop a bomb on the United States. That was what it was designed to do. And, of course, if you fly from the Soviet Union to the United States, you essentially go into orbit, so that the same vehicle obviously was quite able to put a small satellite into orbit. And the amazing thing is that the R-7 now, largely, the most of it is still the R-7, is now the Soyuz rocket. And the Soyuz rocket then, of course, 4 years later launched Gagarin. And the most astounding thing is, you know, that Americans today, if they want to go to space, they have to go to Russia and pay through the nose to fly on the Soyuz rocket. And it's the same R-7 designed, back in the 1950s, early 1950s. So extraordinary piece of history, really. And I always say that if Gagarin was alive today, he would be absolutely amazed that Americans, to get to space, are still flying on the same old rocket that he flew on.
Well, you know, that may change if SpaceX and some of these other providers actually get their human rockets and capsules approved by NASA to carry humans to the space station. So that may change in a couple of years. We may see them going.
That's right. That's what we're really all hoping for. Keeping our fingers crossed. Yeah.
Did you watch the? Go ahead.
Sorry.
I
was just going to say about the Soyuz rocket. An acquaintance of mine from some years ago was doing some satellite work and was looking for a launcher, and so kind of did a survey of, you know, all the available launchers, and said he was absolutely impressed with the Soyuz. He said it was a terrifically simple, robust design. Very easy to work with, and so on, and that explains presumably why it's sort of the DC-3 of expendable rockets, isn't it? They've built, I think, it's nearly 1,800 now of this, basically the same rocket, and it's the workhorse. It's the one that's way ahead of all the other rockets that have ever been orbital launch vehicles.
So I've seen. I was going to say I've seen pictures of them launching it. So they bring it up on a mobile platform in a snowstorm, and everybody's wearing really heavy jackets and coats, and, you know, the damn snow and wind is blowing, and they launched the damn thing in the snowstorm. I mean, it's really robust. when it works.
Right. They have a factory, and I think it's a little railway line, isn't it? Straight out of the factory with it horizontal.
Uh-huh.
It goes to the pad there, and then is put up vertically. And as you say, I mean, I guess it's Kazakhstan, isn't it, the main launch site?
Right.
So that to be able to launch all year round, it's got to be all weather. It's really very good.
Yeah, I mean, our rockets aren't like that. I mean, you got upper winds and you cancel the flight. So we have much more delicate rockets than what Russia has.
Right.
Were you able to see?
And they also.
Go ahead. We've got a gap between our two phone lines, so it's I feel like I should start saying over,
you know,
like shortwave radio. I was going to ask you if you saw the Elon Musk talk the other night, well, it was night California time, regarding his revised plans for going to Mars.
I didn't actually see the talk, but I read a little piece about it. Yeah. Well, I wish him luck. I think I've probably said before on the show that I'm much more interested in the moon than Mars myself, because I see the moon as becoming a huge tourist center, whereas Mars, it's kind of difficult to see how, at least until we get much more powerful rockets. You know, it takes a year to get there, and so as far as just, you know, straight tourism is concerned, it's more like a one-way thing, isn't it? And so it's not really a sort of profit-making business, I wouldn't have thought, is it?
He has plans to have a lunar village, Musk does, you know, as part of a learning and stepping stone process for his Mars plans, because the moon is closer and shorter term, obviously, in terms of human and technology development. So Musk does have plans for using his big rocket to go to the moon. And we keep hearing that NASA is going to announce a lunar return policy. Maybe we'll hear that tomorrow, because tomorrow the first meeting will convene of the revised National Space Council, and maybe they will come out with a policy recommendation to return to the moon, and then it'll be a fact rather than just speculation. But go ahead.
That sounds good. Did you see an announcement the other day which came from Russia, but I don't know if it's really determined, but saying that the Russian space agency will collaborate with NASA on a lunar orbital station.
Yes,
we started in 2022.
We've been talking about that. So that's the orbiting lunar space station with Lockheed as the primary contractor, and it gets a lot of criticism. I mean, we've had listeners calling the show or emailing the show thinking it's a total waste of time and we ought to just go to the surface of the moon and not bother with something like this. So I think it's called the Deep Space Habitat or something like that, whether it really happens or not. But wouldn't you rather go to the surface of the moon than just have an orbiting space station?
Well, sure. But in terms of infrastructure, if space agencies are going to carry on spending their huge budgets on things that aren't actually tourism, then an orbital station in lunar orbit is clearly a useful piece of infrastructure. It is designed in a way that can then expand into, it's a kind of international spaceport in the sense that lunar traffic, if you think of it on a large scale, you know, like millions of people and so on, you need an orbital kind of port, really, a spaceport in Earth orbit for going to the moon, and an orbital spaceport in lunar orbit, and you'll have sort of shuttle vehicles that just go between them, and then you'll have shuttle vehicles up and down to the surface and back. So I think that an orbital station is potentially a very useful step in creating that infrastructure, really. I mean, you certainly need a spaceport on the lunar surface as well, but there'll probably be several, won't there? I mean, at least at the North Pole and the South Pole and things like that.
Do you think that lunar commerce that you're envisioning can be developed by the private sector, or does it have to be public-private partnerships or government, or at least government involved? What's your economic take on it, not necessarily your technology take on it?
Right. That's the $64,000 question, isn't it? You know, if government money could be used in a useful way, obviously it can help to speed things up. If everything is only going to be left to the private sector, it's still going to take quite a long time. You see, there's nobody, as far as I know, there's no serious plan for a reusable passenger space plane, an orbital passenger space plane yet. You know, this is, you know, of the order of billions of dollars of development cost. And I think we'll have to wait for the suborbital business to get going as a business and be seen to be successful, and then companies will put up the money for orbital. But space agencies, you know, it would only cost about like a few percent of their budget to make serious progress in that direction. So a public-private partnership could really speed things up. But as you know, it's the aviation people, the FAA, and in England, the CAA, who are vocally and, you know, formally supporting space travel for the general public. But of course, they don't have, for that activity, they don't have the budgets of the space station, space agencies. So we're still in a little bit of a bind at the moment. But I think it's going to pick up, though, isn't it?
I don't know. When are we going to see commercial space tourism other than the people that have flown to the space station? We still don't have suborbital flight, do we?
Yeah, it's been an incredibly sad, long delay, hasn't it, after Spaceship One. You know, I didn't guess it was going to be 13 years later still that would have even flown on a suborbital flight.
Well, it may be, if we add the usual two-year delay, it may be 15 years later and then 17 years. I don't know. It doesn't, it just doesn't seem to get going, does it?
Yeah.
A lot of
delays.
The promising
thing is you've already seen the announcements by both Russian company and a Chinese company that they're going to start test flights of suborbital passenger vehicles in 2020. Well, that's still in another 3 years, but I would think that both of those will happen, won't they? I mean, the whole of Russia and the whole of China, they've got enormous capability, and it's such a tiny investment compared to their main space programs. I don't know in those countries what the public-private aspect is. I don't know how much it's just purely private or how much government money is involved. But I would think, I'm currently expecting both of those to be realized. And I think if that happens, then I think that the 2020s, we should see suborbital traffic really build up, I think.
You have an email question from Sherry, and Sherry's in Portland, Oregon. And Sherry says, Dr. Collins, the topics that David and you are discussing are familiar topics to people who either are space enthusiasts, space advocates, or in the space industry, specifically in the U.S., but maybe also in parts of Europe and elsewhere. I'm wondering what the knowledge level is of the general public in Japan on the kind of topics you've been discussing so far, as well as their interest in space development, particularly commercial space development.
Yeah, it's a good question. In Japan, the idea of space tourism is very popular. It's not very widely known as yet, but the promising thing is that the Virgin Galactic, as you know, have about 700 customers who've paid, about $200,000 each,
right,
to be in the list of customers. And there's 20 in Japan who've paid up, and there's several hundred on a sort of a list of interest. Because I know this because the guy who's the head of the Virgin Galactic office here in Japan is a member of the Society for Space Tourism in Japan, which I'm one of the people who run that. And what we always say is, you know, when the first Japanese customer goes to America and flies to space and comes back, it'll be a sensation. It'll be across all of the newspapers, all the news stations, and so on. And it'll be the paradigm shift. I mean, everyone will just say, oh, anyone can go to space. Oh, okay, it's still expensive, but they know that once it starts, it gets cheaper and cheaper because things do, like air travel. You know, everyone in Japan is aware that it just gets going, goes on getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But, you know, the low-cost airlines, the low-cost carriers are doing their work in Japan too, finally. And so there's sort of potential for it to grow very quickly. And there's several companies in Japan which are talking about space tourism now. The main one, very good, recently, was a press conference by the head of ANA, which is one of the two big airlines in Japan, and the head of HIS, which is the biggest travel agency in Japan. And they had a press conference with a third guy who's the head of a small engineering company planning to build a suborbital rocket. they're, unfortunately, they're still rather far away, but anyway. And they announced that they, you know, they're keen on space travel and they're going to support this activity in various ways. And, you know, discussing how to do that. The good thing is that ANA and HIS are both very well known and very popular companies. So that, that helps a lot to raise the level of interest.
Does it?
And there's plenty of companies.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, there's several companies, you know, I've spoken to plenty of people and they say, you know, basically, we're waiting for this business to start in the United States, and once it starts in the United States, we'll do stuff as well in various combinations. There's also one of the engineering companies here is working with the EADS in France, you know, because if you remember, EADS in France, which is the giant, the owner of Airbus and various other companies and Ariane Space, they announced in 2007, so already 10 years ago, at the Paris Air Show that they were going to build a suborbital passenger vehicle. But the parent company said, we aren't going to pay for it. You know, we need to raise the money. If we can raise the money, we'll do it. But their estimate was, you know, billions and billions of dollars. So it hasn't progressed very far. But work is continuing, apparently. And one of the Japanese engineering companies is helping them in the engine that they're developing for that. I think it's a methane rocket engine. So... it's not the awareness of passenger space travel and so on, and the potential isn't very high in Japan, but it's kind of potentially quite high. When there's a bit of news, when there's a flight by Virgin Galactic or something, the websites I'm associated with, they get a spike, you know, several thousand people look up space tourism on the web and read about it, and then it goes flat again. But so I tend to think it'll grow very quickly. Once it seriously becomes a service, I think it'll grow faster than most people expect.
Would the average Japanese man or woman on the street know the early October history that we talked about during the first part of our show today?
That's a good question. I don't think they would know about October 3rd or October 4th. I had a seminar group with my students here yesterday, and... we were talking about that. They didn't know. But funnily enough, October the 4th is in Japan. It has a space association. It's the day for Tsukimi, which means looking at the moon. And it's just an ancient legend that October the 4th is a good day for looking at the moon. And the local shop, which makes little rice cakes and stuff by hand in the shop there, they make special looking at the moon. They call them dango, which is a little round ball of soft rice paste. And you sort of eat them with various things. And so I bought a pack of these Tsukimi dango, as they're called, looking at the moon, rice balls. And the students are very happy to eat them. And as we did so, I explained to them about October the 4th and October the 3rd. And they knew the name Gagarin. They know the name Sputnik, but they didn't. I said, what do you think happened in 1950s? And they said, the Apollo project or something like that. So they're like, well, you know, they're only about 20 years old, so... 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it all merges into the ancient past, I think, doesn't it?
I guess, which is kind of unfortunate. Do they believe that we actually went to the moon and walked on the moon, or do they think that's all just a big myth now?
Now, that's a good question. I think most of them believe it okay. And, you know, there's plenty of what they like to call conspiracy theories, which are true. But personally, I don't go for the one that they didn't land on the moon. Because it seems to me the main evidence that they didn't is these photos, which are clearly made up on the Earth. But it seems to me those are just backup photos. I mean, suppose during the flight the cameras had broken or they dropped it or something and there was no record, they would have had to have made backup photos for that very eventuality, I think. I mean, we can't talk about that in detail now. But no, they're not. I don't think they're suspicious about that because... the space agency here, their flights, they're pretty popular. They launch satellites every now and again. And there was a terrific peak a few years ago when a satellite called Hayabusa was launched and went to an asteroid and collected several grams of dust and brought them back successfully to the Earth, the first in history, a very, very good success. That was massively popular in Japan, and so popular they made two films about it, you know, fictional movies about the whole project. So there's a sort of a simmering level of considerable interest in Japan, including particular interest in what Japan does, you know, what Japan's own achievements. The astronauts are very popular figures here. They always get big audiences when they give a talk somewhere.
Well, the orbiting cameras on the moon spot and photograph the hardware left on the moon from time to time, and unless you believe the pictures are fraudulent. You know, they release the pictures and show you the hardware that's on the moon. I mean, it's small little dots, but
pretty good evidence.
But again, you'd have to believe the photos are fake if you don't believe that the photos are real. That will be a problem for NASA if private parties get to the moon and go to one of these Apollo landing sites and find that there's no footprints and nothing there. Then they have a real hard time explaining that. So if we see them stopping private sector missions going to the moon in perpetuity, maybe one might think that there's a reason for that. But I think we'll be going back to the moon, and I do think we're going to see an official U.S. NASA policy emerge for returning to the moon. I have no clue what it'll look like or what the timetable will be or if it'll be international or U.S. only, but I do think a return to the moon national policy is going to soon be announced by our government, and I support that.
Yeah,
I'd like to see us go back to the moon.
Yeah, I would think so. Because not least because India, China, and Russia have all announced plans for some kind of lunar base or something in the 20s. And the timetable seems right, you know. The 20s is obviously... I mean, you know, even this the Lunar X Prize, it hasn't been finished yet. But, you know, it's just shown the moon is not that far away. It's not that difficult to get to. And it's incredibly interesting, potentially. And so... I would think that there could be, as you say, it's quite interesting to see what exactly they come up with in terms of sort of diplomatic aspects, you know, other countries working with them and so on. But if the 20s become a time for lunar bases, that's really good timing because one of the things they'll be doing is doing some actual engineering, and I'm hoping they're going to start seriously, you know, making concrete and making aluminium and glass out of the lunar regolith and so on. And then really, they can carry on.
You have a note from Ellen in Tucson, Arizona. And Ellen says, a big topic for many in the space advocacy community in the United States and maybe in Europe and Canada as well is the idea of space settlement. Is Japan a space settlement community? Do the people think about that? Do they support that? Or is it not very well known or thought about?
Another very good question. Actually very interesting for Japan because it's not a main topic. It's not a generally popular topic in the sense that Japan still hasn't even got its own space station sort of thing or it doesn't even launch its own people into space yet. But I don't know if the person who sent the message, if Ellen knows the story Gundam. Gundam is the name of a very long-running space story in Japan. It's just coming up to its 40th year. It's all animation, but it's sometimes called the Japanese Star Wars or the Japanese Star Trek. It's enormously popular. Its popularity is growing around the world. If you don't know the story, it's set in the next century when there are lots of space settlements in orbit, and it's set between the people who live on the moon, who live in the space settlements, and live on the Earth. And basically, the overall story is that the people who live in space are having a war of independence from the government of Earth, who says, no, you belong to the Earth. And so there's all sorts of side stories. And the genius of the guy, Mr. Tomino, who's the emeritus chairman of our society, is that he's managed to keep the story popular. It's not really generationally. Every few years, a new side story, as they call it, is set up, which fits the whole overall theme, but is kind of popular with the new generation of young, you know, a new group of young people with new designs and so on. But the reason why it's interesting is because these space settlements, the space colonies, they call them space colonies in the story, are a major part of the story. And they know, there's lots of books about the whole story, you know, the Gundam Empire, and they know Gerard O'Neill was the inventor of space colonies. So, and pretty well every man under the age of about 50 has been a Gundam fan at some point. And they sell over $100 million of plastic models of all of the different vehicles and characters every year still. And so space settlements, as I say, they're called colonies here. You just use the word space colony
right.
in Katakana, the space colony, is a very well-known idea. So, again, potentially, it's a real resource to be tapped. So if there's some group, say, in Phoenix, Arizona, who are kind of working on the space colonies, because it's a great topic, you know, where you get the aluminium from and how you do it and so on. And with 3D printing and stuff nowadays, it's getting more and more feasible, isn't it? There'll be a very willing group of followers, I think, in Japan. And I'm still, you know, I think that all the trends are going our way with, you know, the 3D printing and then crowdfunding and stuff. There's such a potential. I mean, there must be about 40 million Gundam fans in Japan and around the world already. They have international competition of Gundam dioramas and things like this. I met a young Malaysian girl a few years ago who won the under 16 Gundam diorama competition in Hong Kong. And the winner of the adult part was an Italian architect who flew out to Hong Kong to show his diorama. So this is all of anything to do with Gundam has space colonies in it. So look up Gundam. There's tons of stuff on the web. You can download whole episodes, I'm sure.
So it's a little bit
probably translatable. That is, yeah.
It's a little bit like the Star Trek franchise. It's a little bit like Star Trek franchise or Star Wars, isn't it?
That's right. What's different though is that it's much closer to reality in the sense that the science fiction often has, you know, one thing which is, an assumption that's not true, but otherwise the story is realistic. Star Trek and Star Wars are both, you know, really far future with aliens and fast and light travel. Whereas in the Gundam scenario, the only thing that's really incorrect is what they have this thing called Minkowski particles, which allow very efficient rockets. So the key character in the Gundam thing is these things called mobile suits, which are basically giant robots with a pilot sitting in the chest. And these fly about and do a lot of fighting. But they can launch from the ground up into orbit without a giant fuel tank. And they can re-enter and so on. So, but otherwise, it's set just around the Earth and Moon and in space columns, you see. So it's a much more realistic world. And sadly, you know, the idea that people who live in space will have to fight to get their independence from Earth is also quite a realistic story, after all. So it's a really fun universe. If you like, compared to Star Trek and Star Wars, because it's so close to the reality.
I went to many first or early Mars Society conferences. I haven't been in a while. I would really like to go back. But a lot of talks were given, and also went to this group of engineering conferences that used to be given in the late 90s in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I met a lot of people that I'm still close friends with today. And they talked about that probably more than likely U.S. or a version of U.S. law or maybe U.N. kind of law would go to the space colonies. But after a while, they'd get fed up with it and you'd have rebellions against, the Earthlings ruling the space colonies and eventually a type of astro law is what the space attorneys would call it. And I've done many early shows on it. I haven't done one in a long time about it. But on the likely development of astro law, which would be law for the colonies or the settlements developed in space with themselves as the lawmakers and the people in charge, not those back on Earth. So that's exactly kind of what you're
right.
talking about, right?
That's right. I don't know in the Gundam world to what extent they've discussed law or analyzed that. But as you say, it's a really interesting problem or issue. And I'm sure there will be different. You know, once the cost of access to space comes down with mass space travel, then colonies are going to get built. Or they don't have to be a kilometer. It can just be like a big a few hundred meters sort of big hotel. And they can. I think you'll get different groups will simply have different law. And I think you'll have religious groups which will build their own place. And when you go there, you follow their law. And I think it could be a really interesting sort of phase of human history. Really, sort of getting back the freedom that people had when there were still open spaces to conquer, as it were, when settlers from Europe went to America and just did their own thing. There's not much left of that on the Earth anymore. But in space, potentially there is. And you could even have that on the moon, couldn't you? You could have different cities with quite different local law.
Absolutely. Patrick, we're a little past the halfway point. Listeners, I'm going to take our break right here. Patrick and I will be gone for about 3 minutes, but don't go anywhere. And again, if you do want to call us, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. We do answer the phone during the break. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. This is our Wednesday night Space Show program. We thank you for listening to this special Wednesday night program. And our guest, Dr. Patrick Collins, will be with us in a second. But we do want to thank our sponsors for the sponsorship of the second segment of tonight's program. So we do have Orbital ATK, and I guess their name will be changing next year as a result of their merger. But they are a global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and they are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And the AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is the world's largest aerospace pro society. They are a sponsor. We're deeply appreciative of their sponsorship. AIAA has more than 30,000 engineers and scientists from 88 countries dedicated to the global aerospace profession. They have 5 yearly forums, otherwise known as conferences. They publish books, technical journals, and a fabulous magazine, Aerospace America. And they have a collection of over 150,000 technical papers. They develop and maintain standards, honors. They award achievement. They advocate on important policy issues. And they're a really good asset for the space community, including the emerging commercial and new space segment of the space community. Visit them at AIAA.org and go to their events. And when I'm attending an AIAA event, the networking is really out of this solar system. It's just incredible. And I will let you know when I am doing that. So any of you who are attending that particular AIAA event, you can look me up and we can have a coffee or something together at the conference. Celestis is a sponsor, one of my all-time favorite companies, as you know. They are still the only proven provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. And Patrick, did you know that lots and lots of Japanese use Celestis for space burials because cremation is very popular in Japan?
Is that right?
Yeah.
I knew that some people had, but that's good. That's a good sign that Japanese are potentially big space fans, you know. And once, I'm sure once space travel really starts happening, Japan will be a major user and, I'm sure, you know, provider of services.
Absolutely.
And hotel companies. There are some big hotel companies.
Real quickly, listeners, they have a flight coming up from Cape Canaveral at the Kennedy Space Center, and it's called the Celestis Earth Orbit Launch early next year. And they're going to fly on board a Surrey Satellite Technologies OTB satellite. It'll be launched by a Falcon Heavy rocket from Kennedy Space Center, 39A. They used to launch shuttles from 39A. Now they're going to be launching the Falcon Heavy. The Apollo astronauts that we were talking about in the first segment went to the moon from 39A. Family and friends will gather at Cocoa Beach, which is just down the road, for a three-day experience that includes a tour of the Kennedy Space Center, dinner with astronauts, a compelling memorial service, and preferred viewing of the spectacular launch and landing. Remember, they're going to bring back the Falcon Heavy, and you're going to get to see that too. So if you have someone you want to memorialize, or if you want to send your DNA up on this flight, contact them, Celestis.com. And again, in the context of full disclosure, I am their customer. I've done three flights with them and one flight that is at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean someplace on a Falcon 1. And they're wonderful. They have launched my mom and my two dogs on both suborbital and orbital flights. They're the finest people I've ever worked with. I love them to death. They're sensitive. They're caring. The whole experience was beyond dignified and sensitive, and it really will last all my life. I took my son Michael to the suborbital lunch with me at Spaceport America. We had tears of both joy and sadness when that up aerospace rocket launched, and it was both like a carnival and a circus, and like a memorial service in New Orleans with the jazz band going and people playing music and dancing in the streets. I mean, it was amazing, and I just can't recommend them enough. I know I'm going over my 1 minute spot with them, but I love that company, and if you have someone you want to memorialize, you can't do any better than Celestis. And the reason I mentioned the Japanese thing, Patrick, is because land is so scarce in Japan and very, very expensive. Traditional Western-style cemeteries are not as popular or as affordable, so cremation is much more widespread than, say, it is in America. And so there are cremated ashes available to send 1 or 2 grams to space, which is about all you send.
That's right.
And
I think everybody is cremated in Japan. Yeah,
pretty much so. So are there any, it has nothing to do with the show, but are there any ground traditional cemeteries like you find in Western countries in the United States?
Well, there are the cemeteries, but what's inside them is the ash. You see, when I've attended several also funeral services now,
uh-huh.
And the family, there's a service for general people and so on, members, you know, friends and so on, but then the family attend the actual cremation, and the body is put into the furnace, you know, and it takes about 2 or 3 hours to burn it to ash. And then it's brought out, and the family stand around. It's quite weird the first time you do it, but it's absolutely normal in Japan. And the bones are there, you know, the kind of charred white bones and the skull and the legs and things. And then there's a special pot, which is, you know, the family has chosen, you know, a beautiful sort of decorated ceramic pot. And there's a special pair of chopsticks, which we use. And each person in turn picks up some of the bones and puts them in the pot. And so you collect most of the bones of the person, starting at the feet and going up to their head. It's crushed, you know, it's all crushed. But and put them in the pot, and then the pot is wrapped up in a special box and taken home. And then it's kept at certain ceremonies, you know, a week and 2 weeks and 7 weeks and things. But finally, the pot is put into the family tomb. So that there are lots of cemeteries all over Japan, but they don't have the remains of decayed bodies in. They just have the ashes in pots. So, but you're right that there's plenty of ashes then for these services. So I would think Celestis, their service here, will grow. And actually, it reminds me of a professor I used to know here who's now died, but we actually had a meeting, he called together several people, including construction companies, discussing building a cemetery on the moon's surface.
Really?
And I suspect that's a serious business opportunity, because once you put, and the idea was originally just to send some ashes with a little robot. I mean, this is highly doable today, but later on, you know, maybe larger, more ashes or something. But once they're on the lunar surface, you can see them forever. And, you know, your grandparents are there and your parents are there. And everyone in the world can do that. And every country in the world has all sorts of myths about the moon and so on. So it's a really realistic business project, I think. And there'll be whole areas where there'll be basically tombs of, you know, actually the actual ashes of your ancestors actually there. I think it's a
terrific. Well, I mean, it's just like a vial. I mean, it really was a little tiny canister vial.
That's right, just a few grams.
Yeah,
literally a few grams.
Much smaller than what...
But it's actually the person.
Remember the canisters that 35-millimeter film would come in? So it's much, much, much smaller than that kind of a film canister. Much, much smaller. Kind of like a little film, a little pill box you might put on your car keychain to keep one or two pills in it if you're taking a medication or something. Interesting.
Right.
Well, that's a commercial business maybe waiting for someone to develop.
Yeah, I suspect Celestis have got plans for it.
Well, they have sent remains already of people to the moon, and I know they're getting ready to do remains going to Mars when that capability comes about. But
right. Well, good on them. Yeah.
So they're thinking along those lines for sure.
Yeah.
Going back to the space topics, you wanted to say more about some of the early October activities, right?
That's right. October the 3rd. As I said, Space Week, International Space Week, it starts on October the 4th. But I'm a great fan also of October the 3rd. As I said, yesterday was the 75th anniversary of the first ever rocket to reach space. And it's just a great story of engineering. You know, it's one of the most important engineering achievements of the human race. And there's a nice, somebody made the analogy saying that the only other inventions that can be compared to space rocket is a wheel and a propeller. And he said wheels, you know, allowed people to travel, you know, and carry huge amounts of things all around, I think it's the surface of the Earth. The propeller allows us to travel efficiently both through the sea or over the sea and through the sea and through the atmosphere. And, of course, to use a propeller, you have to use lots of wheels for the bearings. And then a rocket engine uses a lot of wheels and bearings, but then allows us to travel through space. And so, as you can imagine, several books written about the development of, it's famously known as the V-2, which is the military version carrying bombs to send to Britain. But during the initial test, it was called the A-4, which is the test rocket. And in Peenemünde, you know, northern Germany up on the Baltic coast. And it was a big project. The engineers, there are about 2,000 engineers, not just for the A-4, but for several other rocket engines. They had rocket engines for the rocket-powered fighter, which they developed, and the various other rockets and so on for weapons. But the big rocket, the A-4, they'd had several test flights which failed. And, you know, in terms of engineering, it had all the contents of a modern rocket. You know, you remember the key problem with a big rocket to get to space is you have to have liquid fuels, liquid oxidizer. So you've got these two liquids. One of them and their ones was liquid oxygen, of course, which is very low temperature as well. And the main thing is you've got to burn a huge amount of it very fast in the chamber. So it's at high pressure in the chamber. So then you've got to force the liquids into the chamber at high pressure. So you have to have these what they call turbo pumps, which are high-powered pumps which pump the fuel under high pressure into the chamber and burn. And they were the Germans were, I mean, literally years and years ahead of anybody else in this and developed this whole system. And then a very lightweight rocket structure. And then the control system. You know, one of the big problems for these things is always the control, you know, because it's high pressures and high temperatures and traveling high speed and so on. In a half a second failure, the whole thing blows up and so on. So the control system was key, and they used radar for the guidance. And so, you know, a whole lot of innovations they were developing. And on the 3rd of October, I think this was, they had a budget, and this was the last flight they could afford. The others were failures. It was a strong possibility that if this flight had failed, they were going to be, the whole thing would be just scrapped, you know, in wartime conditions, you know, everything's rationed, and you can't just waste much money for very long. And so anyway, when they launched the previous ones, they would have throughout the campus there was a loudspeaker system, and they would have a guy reading, counting out the seconds after the takeoff. And it was meant to fly for several minutes and then go and land in the, or crash into the Baltic Sea, several hundred kilometers away. And until then, always, you know, he'd go, ein, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, and then the thing would blow up. Or he'd get to, I think, 10 or 15 seconds, and it would blow up. So anyway, on this time, midday, October 3rd, lovely sunny day, apparently, in early October, sort of, you know, Indian summer type thing. And so he was counting. And, you know, I don't really know German, but 21, 22, 23, you know, going on and on and on. And he said as the numbers went up and up, no failure, it was going okay. Everyone started jumping and shouting and singing and hugging each other and kissing and crying. And just it was just this fantastic success because it was going to space. And it got to space, something like it. I'm not sure if it was exactly 100 kilometers, but it was 80 or 90 kilometers high. And carried on completely. And the guy was counting, you know, two, three minutes, I think it was, finally. And this total success. And so, of course, everybody had these parties in the evening. And the group of top engineers, which, of course, included von Braun, but the guy in charge was Dornberger, General Dornberger, because it was a military project, gave a speech, which still isn't very famous, but I think one day will be as famous as any speech in the world. Because he, you know, he talked a little bit, and he said that, well, humans have been traveling over the Earth, you know, for at least a million years. We've been traveling over the sea for, well, thousands of years now. We know people are using sailing boats thousands of years ago. And we've been traveling through the atmosphere for 40 years at that time, the first flights in the beginning of the century. And he said, today, we've proved that humans can travel in space. No, a total breakthrough, and once the war's over, space travel. And they drank a toast to space travel. And they not only drank a toast to it, but they were preparing for it as well as they could, even during the war, because they put wings on an A-4. I called it the A-4B and flew that, and that was basically to allow it. Well, it could travel further distance, but it could also land. And they designed and were developing a piloted version. They had you can find the pictures on the web quite easily, the piloted A-4B. And that would have been the first fully reusable piloted space plane and would have gone up to space and come back and landed. And they were, if they had this design in, well, early 40s. So if the war had ended in a normal way, in a usual way up till then, where, you know, the combatants sign a peace treaty and is left at that, they would have started suborbital space flights in the 1940s. Of course, the war didn't end like that. It ended where the Soviet Union and America insisted, and Britain insisted on unconditional surrender, and then basically stole everything they wanted, which was included all the space engineers and all the rockets and all the rocket technology and everything like that, and made them build missiles for the next 50 years. But if they'd started suborbital space flights in the late 40s, you may know that the first jet flight was in 1952, not the first jet passenger flights. There was a thing called the Comet 4, which is the English airliner, which was the first passenger jet flight. So actually, you know, people tend to think space flight is terribly futuristic and difficult. It should have started, if engineering had had its normal way, the first passenger space flights would have started before the first passenger jet flights, which is, you know, it's a big, big, big distortion in history that... Here we are, 75 years later. Today's 75th, or yesterday was 75th anniversary. Still waiting for the space flight to start that they drank a toast to on October the 3rd.
Well, so judge getting space flighting started, or having Germany won the war, or not having unconditional
surrender. Well, that's right. If they'd won the war, I suppose that would have continued. They almost did it anyway, you know, towards the end of the war, of course, everything got much more tight and difficult, so they didn't have the spare time. An interesting story about von Braun himself. You probably know there's a famous photo of him on the web of the German Rocket Society. It was set up in the 1920s.
Uh-huh.
Because you remember this famous science fiction film called Frau im Mond about the woman in the moon?
Yes.
Black and white movie. It was 1927, was it, or something? 27, 28, something like that.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And there's a photo of the German Rocket Society with von Braun in shorts. He's only a teenager. And there's a bunch of them holding a rocket at the time. This didn't have turbines or anything. This was just basically a big kind of firework. But He was arrested in 1944 because someone overheard him in a bar where he was drinking a beer with a friend, saying he wasn't very interested in missiles, he just wanted to travel in space. And he was arrested. And it took Dornberger quite a long time to get him unarrested, because at that time, as the war was going badly, you know, governments don't like people sounding, you know, unenthusiastic. And but he managed to persuade him to let him out, because he said, you know, without him, we can't finish this project. But it's important to remember that right from the very start, you know, they knew that rockets meant space travel. And I mean, as visionaries, real visionaries.
So why is it so hard for the private companies to do what governments did a long, long time ago?
Right. It's the thing that's sort of surprising since Spaceship One, this long delay, is that the investment world won't invest in these projects. We're lucky that with the internet, a number of people have got very rich very quickly while they're still young. And so they're still young enough to want to do things like space travel. And so that's been a major source of the money. Richard Branson, of course, his money wasn't for the internet, but he became very rich through his companies and did that. And if you remember, when he ran out of money after his first $200 million, he raised $300 million from the Middle East, one of these big investments up there, the Harbor.
I think it was an Abu Dhabi investment group.
Yeah. That's
so,
right.
And, so they invested in it.
I'm hoping. Sorry?
Well, they invested in it, but remember, Russia, well, okay, let's say that Germany did it, but then you also have Russia and you have the United States that was doing suborbital and perfected suborbital and docking and rendezvous and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And these guys, I mean,
that's right, the
instruction manual exists. So they still aren't there yet.
That's right.
I mean, yeah. I know
you,
they want to...
You remember the movie, The Right Stuff,
where, of course.
When he first, Chuck Yeager first breaks the sound barrier so they know they can fly supersonically, there's a journalist there who's just about to phone his newspaper to put a thing, and somebody comes and shuts it down and says it's all secret, you can't publicize that. And so a lot of that, the test, you know, the X-1, X-2, X-3 and so on, up to the X-15, was kind of secret at the time, because of the Cold War. And I suppose if it hadn't been secret, it would have been much more likely that investors would have come along, because the X-15 flew lots of times to space and back, and, you know, they had it weighed off by then. And they even had, you remember, the Valkyrie, big carrier rocket, a carrier rocket-powered, aircraft, but a supersonic aircraft, was going to carry it up. And I'm not sure if the Valkyrie plus the X-15 would have got to orbit, but very nearly. What I mean is that the people doing that project, you know, they knew the real objective is to get to orbit. And so two-stage horizontal takeoff rocket and jet-powered vehicles could, you know, they knew they could do it in the 60s, basically. But it was all scrapped in 68, the X-15 project. And ever since then, the space agencies have just depended on expendable rockets. Presumably because they existed, you know, they were there. The Soviet Union started with missiles, and that was the quickest thing to do, I suppose.
Yeah, but again, I know the privates want reusable and they want to carry people and passengers, so, you know, there are different considerations. But again, it's not like you have to reinvent the wheel, right? So
no, absolutely.
It's
the current.
I realize there are challenges, but we didn't expect these kinds of challenges to be this much of a delay. That's lousy grammar, but you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, that's right.
Anyway,
I probably mentioned it before, but when Richard Branson first talked to Bert Rutan about building him a space plane, he said, remember there's the Fry letter, which is the letter from one of the airlines in the States, I think it was United, was it, to Douglas Company to build the DC-3, became the DC-3. And, you know, in the history of aircraft, the DC-3 is most famous because it sold like tens of thousands of things. The most aircraft only sell a few hundred, and some sell a few thousand. And the DC-3 just 10 times as much as any of them.
And so
the Fry letter, which was a short letter describing what aircraft he wanted, was the trigger that allowed the company to build it and so on. And so Branson wrote a letter saying, I'll buy, you know, four sets of vehicles, carry six passengers and so on. He said to Rutan, you go to the banks and stuff and investors and raise the money. And Rutan said he couldn't raise the money. Although he was world famous, especially when he had flown to space and he had an order, he couldn't raise the money. And that's the real sort of shocking thing. So that was when Branson said, well, I've never invested in development before, and I don't know anything about development, but I can't say no. And so he paid for the development. And he made a speech at Oshkosh saying, I'm really not sure if we're going to make any money out of this, because I'm an operator, not a developer. And, you know, he was kind of prescient in the sense he didn't think it was going to take 13 years. And it's the failure of the private sector of investors to not pay for that, you know, which is the big delay now. And I recently, you know, been writing things about the history of transportation systems. And if you think of the, say, six of the big transportation systems of the last few centuries, the horse carriage, and then sailing ships, and then steam trains, and then steamships, and then cars, and then aircraft. Now, these are six major transportation technology inventions, and each of them became a gigantic industry, spreading around the entire world and employing tens of millions of people. And you know, today, the car industry must employ probably 200 million people, but directly and indirectly. Aviation employs about 100 million, if you include all of the, you know, the tourism that is made possible by aircraft. So each of these new technologies was absolutely huge implications, growing for decades, if not even more than a century, like cars and aircraft and so on. And I just say that rocket propulsion is exactly the same. It's just in that line, and it should have started in the 40s and grown into a just gigantic transportation system. There's absolutely no reason to suppose it wouldn't have done if it had got started with reusable passenger carrying. And it's just been this long, long delay. And when it does start, it will certainly grow and grow and grow, just like all the others. And, you know, when you said space travel, space tourism has three phases, you know, starting suborbital and then orbital and then lunar, because these are all straightforward. They've all been done. They've all been done 50 years ago or more. And there's a huge demand for all of them. So that it's just, it's a sort of, if you like, a failure of the democratic capitalist world to have still not done what it needs to do. And, you know, we're getting there. We are getting there. It's ridiculously slow. And hopefully the prod from now Russia and China and India all planning to do it as well, we'll finally get even American investors as I say, don't get mad, get even, and just shoot ahead and do it. It's certainly very possible.
Jack is in Denver, Colorado, with an email for you. Easton, what is your take on the changes to the industry that SpaceX has brought and now Blue Origin?
Yeah, the more people who try to build reusable passenger vehicles, the better, for sure. And, you know, it's famous that both the car industry and the aircraft industry had lots and lots of companies. You know, today we're used to the idea of sort of for aircraft as Boeing and Airbus and a few others. But even in England alone, there was like 100 aircraft, no, maybe not 100, but about 50 aircraft companies at one point. In America, must be hundreds. And so having lots of companies trying different approaches is a very good step. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think any of the suborbital vehicles being proposed at the moment are going to be the DC-3 of suborbital space yet, suborbital space, and not the DC-3 of orbital. And there's no clear project yet to build an orbiting vehicle. And I suspect there will be both vertical takeoff and horizontal takeoff. And as I understand it, the vertical takeoff, single stage, is kind of pretty well possible. So horizontal takeoff, it's best really to start with two stages at the moment because the propulsion is much easier that way. I'm still waiting to see a two-stage horizontal takeoff and a single-stage vertical takeoff system for going to orbit and back. And so we know all of the Virgin and Blue Origin and SpaceX are kind of working in that direction. But none of them is suitable as they stand for development in an orbital vehicle. So since the main objective is to get to orbital systems, as I've said before, I'm a great fan of Bristol Space Planes, which their plan is to develop two-stage or horizontal takeoff reusable passenger vehicles. And their suborbital plan is based on heading in that direction. So it's a sort of step-by-step process to get there.
Are they still in business? Are they still trying to do things?
Well, yes. Oh, very much. They're a virtual company in the sense that David Ashford, who's the founder and so on, he's a retired aerospace development engineer, and he is working on these plans, and he has a team who, once he's funded, will develop the first step, which is a suborbital vehicle. But the first phase of that, to make it even lower cost, is a suborbital vehicle without rocket engine, just jet engine, so it can be do the low-speed flying tests and demonstration flights to investors to show that the company can do what it says it can do.
But you know, he was a guest on the space show back when I started out, and but nothing's ever happened with him. I mean, that's another one that hasn't gone anyplace, right?
Right. When you say nothing's ever happened, he's had a number of contracts, both from government and from other companies, to write reports explaining the feasibility of his system. And he's, for example, if you know, in 2014, the British government, the Civil Aviation Authority, published a report which was justifying their plans, which are underway, to build a spaceport in Britain. It was triggered, they say, by Virgin Galactic, because Virgin Galactic wants to fly from Britain. But nevertheless, there's a report on the web from the CAA about that project. There's a 100-page executive summary and a 400-page full report. Very readable. In some ways, it's a good introduction, because the FAA has so much material on space travel on their website, like thousands of pages, that it's a bit difficult to know where to start, whereas this CAA report, just written by the aviation people, is a straight explanation of the issues and so on, and very, very businesslike. You know, we have to do this, and various issues arise. You know, for example, are the FAA rules suitable for Britain, and so on. And David Ashford's project is in that. They have a list of projects which they expect to see develop and so on. So he's very well accepted and acknowledged within the British aerospace industry. It's just there isn't as yet serious funding for his company or for others. You may know that the British government put £50 million, which is quite a lot of money, into this reusable engine.
Yeah, I know, reaction engine.
By reaction engine.
Right, I'm very aware of that.
The problem about that is that, if it works, it's a great idea, but to make use of it, their project to develop the space plane they want is billions of pounds. And there's no way, I don't think, the British government's going to put up billions of pounds, because it's not even for a passenger vehicle, so that they're restricted to satellite launch. So it's not really a business proposition. Whereas the same 50 million put into Bristol space planes, you'd just about get a first passenger carrying, you'd get a prototype passenger carrying a space plane, you see. So that I think it's the situation is pregnant, one might say. It's looking much better than it was even a few years ago. But, of course, endlessly frustratingly slow.
But Ashford was on the show in 2003 and then 2005. You introduced me to him. And I really thought that he would be able to build and test his vehicle. But
that's right. You should give him a call and get him on again. What you'll find is his plans have moved on. And his initial step, that for which he requires investment, is much smaller and lower cost than it was before. And there's a rocket guy in America, I've forgotten his name now, but who, just out of interest as a rocket guy, built a version of the rocket engine which Ashford is using, which is hydrogen peroxide engine, just because there's huge experience of that. And he's tested it on a test stand, and there's a video of him testing the engine, so that things have progressed quite a lot over the last 10
years. Are you still in touch with him?
Oh, yes, indeed. We're very old friends and colleagues.
Is he coherent to be on radio now? I know he's a much older gentleman.
Oh, yeah, no, he's absolutely fine. He's very well. Not only is he very well, he's in his 70s now.
Okay.
But his father is, I think, 93 and still driving. So he's got good longevity in his genes, I think.
Is his email still Spaceman? Or does he have a different...
I'll send it to you. I'll email it to you. But if you look for BristolSpaceBlends.com, it's all there, yeah. BristolSpaceBlends.com, again, has got lots of material. Interesting descriptions and explanations of the logic of his whole design. And I've never seen anyone critique his designs. I mean, for me, his kind of encyclopedic knowledge of aerospace. And just to give a simple example, when Branson's plans were first announced, he immediately said he's made a mistake. And I said, what's that? He said, look, the business plan you have to have for just starting suborbital spaceflight is you've got to get a license to carry passengers as soon and as cheaply as possible. And that's obviously the timeline that you're working on, your critical path, okay? And he said, Spaceship One has flown to space 3 times successfully. So you know it can fly to space and back successfully. And it carries a pilot, and it could carry 2 passengers. So he said, by far the cheapest and quickest thing to do is to use that vehicle, build several more copies of it, and fly them as many times as you need to get a license. It'd probably be 100 times or even maybe a few more times. But whatever, that's the quickest way. And then you start. You're in business. You can carry 2 passengers at a time, and you've got revenue coming in, and away you go. But Branson said, no, it's too small. I want to carry 6 passengers. So Ashford said, well, that's a perfectly good idea, but get your license for the existing one that's been to space and then do a stretched version. It's much, much easier to get a license for a stretched version of an existing license vehicle than to start from scratch. And lo and behold, he spent $500 million, and nothing has flown to space in 13 years, and he's had a serious accident, a loss of a test pilot, and we hope he's going to succeed as soon as possible. But, it's not certain that Spaceship 2 can fly to space. There's stories about whether it's quite the right power system and so on, propulsion system and so on. And so I have to say that his judgment, in my experience, his judgment of all of these different systems is always correct. So I suspect if his own system is also correct.
Well, I will send me his address, and I'll see if he wants to come back on the show after all these years. 17.
Yes, right, later. And bring you up to date on what he's working on his entry level system at the moment. Going back to. If I may, just going back to October the 3rd, it's interesting that October the 3rd is also, nowadays, it's Germany's Unification Day. It's the day they celebrate the reunification of Germany after the collapse of the Cold War and the bringing down of the Berlin Wall. And I have to think that somebody, when they were deciding what day should they set as the day of German unification, they chose the day of one of the most historic achievements in the history of engineering to make it. Unification Day. So I don't think many Germans know that. I know some who do, but I think it's lying in wait for when they're allowed to make more noise about it.
We're pretty much at the end of our 90-minute program. What time is it in Japan, by the way, in Tokyo?
Here it's 12:30, so just coming up to lunchtime.
Okay. Any concluding comments, anything you want us to hold on to until the next time we talk?
What I was talking about just now, these earlier transportation technologies, you remember, say, horse carriages, sailing ships, trains, ships, steamships, and then cars and then aircraft. Each of those became a kind of 100 million employing gigantic industry, and I foresee that space travel can do exactly the same. And you probably know that the world's economy is in a very bad state. There's a very European, American, and Japanese economies, all very weak situation. A lot of people say the American economy is about to go back into recession when the bubble in the stock market bursts and so on. And to my mind, from the point of view of sort of macroeconomics, we're missing new industries. There's a lack of new industries. We've moved most of the old industries out into cheaper countries, and of course we have the very high unemployment, saying, what should we do now? We should be doing spaceflight. And I think, as I said, the logical development would have been that suborbital spaceflight would have started at latest in the 1950s. So orbital would have started in the 60s and 70s. We'd have cities on the moon by now, and we can do that. And the technology is absolutely ripe and waiting. And just from the quality of the phone calls which came in just now, or the emails which came in just now, there's obviously a huge community in America of very well-informed people, about what's possible and what's, really interesting to do. And it's just a question of getting it to happen. And I think I would say to everybody, hang in there. It's much more promising now than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. The whole idea of space tourism is much better known. There's several companies trying hard. We still haven't, the growth of the internet and crowdfunding and so on still hasn't really got into gear, but I can't help feeling that it's just really almost there, and somebody's going to be able to raise a whole lot of money for more of these projects. And then once it gets going, it'll never stop. It can't possibly stop.
No, I agree with you, and it does represent an entirely new front to an industrial base, which all countries need right now. And it's kind of mind-boggling that you don't hear it talked about by the people making policy and claiming that they're going to bring new industry development. What they want to do is rehash all the old industry, and they think the old industry is going to be competitive if they do this and that and the other, or bring it back to the United States. But that's not going to be competitive. What has to happen is new industry, and it's a whole different world. And keep doing that. Keep innovating and keep developing new industry. And if we open up space for a real industrial development and a real addition to our economy, I can't even imagine where it would be in 20 years from now. But we're sort of...
Right. And for all its problems, the United States is where it's going to be, if not the center, or at least a massive contributor to it, because of not just the technology, but just the spirit, you know, Americans, and the people who do that kind of stuff, you know. And Japanese are great in all sorts of ways, but they don't have that same attitude to entrepreneur. No, why not? Let's just have a go. And so on.
And you don't hear that.
Go, go, go.
But you know, I listen to the political campaigns and the politicians and their plans for industrial growth and economic growth, and can we get to 3%, and can we do this, and can we do that? And the entire economic development of Earth is omitted, and yet it is right there to be started with by the private sector.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And by the way, all of this money is spent here on Earth, and a lot of it is on ground. It's not even in space, because a lot of it is ground facilities and hardware and infrastructure.
That's right. That's right.
So it's mind-boggling that these idiots omit it and gloss over it or don't get it. Maybe you should come here and go on the lecture circuit or something for economic development.
Some people get it, because, you know, several of the state governments have set up spaceports, haven't they? And they've done that on the basis that they can see this is
going to
happen.
Yeah, but there's no business
for them.
But again, they're
just let down by the delays.
Yeah, and then Spaceport America, they've got $250 million of bonds to pay interest on, and they have no revenues. So, you know, the people of New Mexico, which is one of our poorest states, are really screwed and strangled by this. So they thought about laying the spaceport off to commercial interest, but there's no interest in that because it's a white elephant. So they got a new spaceport director now, so maybe he'll come up with it. But, you know, if you don't have the business there to generate the revenues because the delays are there, and Virgin is a big part of the delays, then you still have to pay the bond interest, don't you? The bond owners want their interest. Got to pay it.
Yeah. Delay is terrible.
Delay
is very
costly. But the opportunities are really there. And, boy, if you want to develop the economy of the United States and other countries, start investing in space and infrastructure and jump-starting it so that it can receive, investment opportunity, investment. And you will build wealth, and it will grow, and I'm convinced of it. That's why I started the space show and wrote my dissertation on the subject way back when, if you recall. And all of that is just, it's still pregnant, you know, still waiting for delivery.
It's pending. It's pending.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, maybe by the next time. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you remember Jeff Bezos said that he's going to invest $1 billion a year from now on. Well, that would, if it's spent in a good way, that could be very helpful. That's about the sort of money we need.
Absolutely, and maybe by the next time you come on the show, we'll see some progress starting in this light, and maybe this show and others like it, and other people doing things will help out. But the opportunity is there, and it's just too bad it's glossed over and omitted and not understood, and no one in the media talks about it, and it really is there.
Yeah.
It needs to be started in a big way, but we'll see.
We had a new member to our society recently who came along, and he's a senior guy from a giant advertising company in Japan. And his first words when we met was, he said, "I want to do the Olympics on the moon." And to have a guy from and a big marketing company with that in his mind. Now, that's great help, you know, and so that's really helpful as, you know, bringing in the purely kind of, you know, populistic kind of idea.
Kind of,
I mean, there's lots of things to talk about that as well, but just to give the idea is spreading and more people are joining in. I think, well, this frustration. We need new industries, so it's happening, but it's just too slow. Yeah.
Patrick, until the next time, okay? And we'll keep trying to make it happen
right, faster.
Thank you for being with us again, and I'll look forward to talking to you again down the road. I'll let you know what happens when I contact David Ashford, and if he's going to be on the show, I'll give you a heads up.
Good.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks very much. Really good fun.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it for tonight. We want to thank those of you who sent in emails, and thanks to Dr. Patrick Collins and everyone else. Have a great week. So Friday is John. God, I'm having a simple senior moment again. I can't believe this. Our nuclear weapons guy on Mars, John Brandenburg, the plasma physicist, will be back with us. And Sunday is open line. So everybody finish out the week in great form. Keep it safe. Keep looking up. And we will be back on Friday morning with another Space Show program. Goodbye from Patrick. Goodbye from David. And goodbye from the show.